Let's open our Bibles. We'll be in the book of Genesis this evening, chapter 25. Genesis 25. You know, one of the most wonderful things about belonging to the Lord that we sort of take for granted, I think, at least I know I take it for granted, and that is that His work is more important than we are. It may seem odd that that should be such a blessing, but it is a blessing. It seems odd that we should say to ourselves, something is more important than we are. Because our world basically spends a lot of time and money telling us that nothing is more important than I am, or than we are, or than a human is. And, you know, live for yourself, and if you're not getting what you want, if you're not getting what you need, all this stuff, you know, you got to do what you got to do to get what you want. And the sense really is one of, it's pretty much self-worship, which is where humanism has to go, and humanism is really what's going on in philosophically in our culture, among other things. But one of the wonderful relief aspects of belonging to Christ is the relief of not having to live for yourself. The relief of realizing there is really someone more important than I am, not to mention the fact that a lot of people around me are more important than I am, but God is more important than I am. And His program and what He's doing in the earth is more important than me, more important than what I like, more important than what happens to me. It's odd, but that's a huge relief. It's also something of a challenge because it means that He will at times call upon me to sacrifice in order to see His will done. And this is not uncommon throughout the history of people who've known God. But the wonder of it is that it's worth sacrificing for. It is worth waiting for what God has. It is worth being faithful to what God says, because He really is going to win, and He really knows what He's doing. And to know that your life and your purposes go beyond this world, though we have temporal purposes too, that many things that we have to do here and now and we're involved in and enjoy and so on. But to know that your life goes beyond these things is the awesome, awesome privilege of being in covenant with God. It gives you this foundation to your life. It gives you a purpose. And it gives you something to think about when the other things in your life aren't going so well. And the reason I say these things in introductory comments to a Bible study in Genesis 25 is essentially because Genesis 25 opens with the leftovers of Abraham's life, in a sense. He had a whole family after Sarah died. Did you know that? He had a whole other family after Sarah died. And then we read of Abraham's death. But that's not where we're going to stop. What happens is the pen of God, so to speak, as he writes, continues right straight through Abraham's death and on into Isaac's life. And then amazingly, right through Isaac's death and on into Jacob's life, and right through Jacob's death and on into Joseph's life, and right through Genesis and on into Exodus, and right through Exodus and on into Numbers, and so on and so forth. The amazing thing is, no matter how important you are to God at any given time in your life, you're never indispensable. His plan keeps on going, and you're part of that larger plan. That is a challenge, and it is a relief. It is a challenge and it is a relief. You're part of a larger plan. Abraham is important to us because he was a covenant man. He was the man through whom God began covenant relationship with humanity. But one of the things we learn, especially as we get to the end of his life, is that God's covenant doesn't stop when one of his people gets laid to rest. His covenant keeps on going, and that's the whole point. That is the whole point. Let's begin in Genesis 25, and we'll go on into the life of Isaac, and we'll see some things in chapter 26. I think that's as far as we'll get this evening, as God's covenant continues in Isaac's life. But Genesis 25, verse 1, Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah, and she bore to him Zimran and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and Ishbak and Shua. And Jokshan became the father of Sheba and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were Ashurim and whatever. And Lahumumimim. And all the rest of these guys were all born to them. Now Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. Now note this, Isaac actually receives all of the covenant blessings. But Abraham, what Abraham does is he basically gives his inheritance to all the others before he dies. When he died, he left everything to Isaac, which was a huge inheritance that he left to him, a huge legacy. Not only a name that was famous throughout Canaan at the time, but hundreds and hundreds of servants and sheep and goats and everything. He was a very wealthy man. He left that all to Isaac. But what he did before he died, as many people do actually before they die, they start giving away the inheritance before they pass away. That's what happens. And that's what he does. He gave all that he had to Isaac, but to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living. And he sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the land of the east. And these were all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. And those last few years, he was still having kids, and he was still being a family man. When God gave Abraham and Sarah the ability to have children, Abraham retained that ability long into his aged years and started a whole new family. I love this. You're not done until you're done, okay? This is good to remember. You're not done until you're done. And we get to the end of Sarah's story, and we think to ourselves, well, that's the end of Abraham's story. But you know, it's interesting, in this particular case, that wasn't the case. Sarah's story came to an end, and God took her home. Abraham had a whole another chapter or two to write before he was finished. You know, you are not finished. If you're still breathing, you are not finished. God still is using you, and he may have more plans for you than you think. Did you know that most people do their most powerful work for God in the last 10 to 15 years of their life? Did you know that? It's an amazing reality. But oftentimes you hit your stride walking with God in your 60s, maybe your 70s, sometimes your 80s. The reason is because age is an advantage in walking with God. It's a disadvantage in pro football, but on the other hand, who cares? We live in a world that sort of glorifies certain things that God says, but in real eternity, age is an advantage. And so you will accomplish much in your latter years if you keep walking with God. This is the key. It's not to sell it short, to sell out earlier on. Keep walking with him so that in your latter years, you're able to serve him. Well, anyway, Abraham had a whole life, kind of, after Sarah had passed away. And I bet he thought his life was over when he was weeping at Sarah's grave. But it wasn't. Abraham breathed his last and died at a ripe old age. I hope to shout. And an old man satisfied with life, and he was gathered to his people. It's interesting. It doesn't say he died and was buried. It says he was gathered to his people. And this is the Bible phrase, because when you die, you don't cease to exist. You're gathered to people. And I think that's wonderful, because for a person who has a covenant with God, when you die, you graduate and you are gathered to all the other people who already graduated ahead of you. And you get there, you close your eyes here, you open your eyes there. We grieve and we do a funeral for you, but you open your eyes there, and all of the buds from throughout history who are ahead of you, they go, whoa, is this a hoot or what? Can you believe how much better this is than it was back there? That is exactly the case. You are gathered to your people. That is a wonderful thing when you have a covenant with God. And I got to believe that Abraham must have been ready at 175. I got to believe he must have been saying, you know, I'm ready. It's been a long time, and I'm ready to go. Because honestly, you know, when you're young and life is opening up in front of you, and by young I mean, you know, less than 70, life might be opening up in front of you, but you know, there comes a point in time where first in little increments and then in much larger increments, you start to say things like, been there, done that, got the t-shirt. and you start looking for the meaning, which seemed to be self-evident when you were young. And then you start saying, you know, what really is it? You know, I've been there. I've done that. I've done that. I don't need to do that again. I've been there. You know, you get to a point at some point in your life where you say, I've been everywhere and I got every t-shirt I'm going to get. And I see more t-shirts out there. I don't want them. I got enough of them. That's not a bad headspace. People say, oh, that person's given up on life. That's a terrible headspace. No, that's not a bad headspace for a person who knows God. It is not a bad headspace for a person who knows God. Do you know that the Christians in the first 2 centuries used to have celebrations when people died? They'd do a parade. They'd carry the coffin like a trophy. It was a parade because it was really seen as a graduation. I think Abraham was ready. And he died at a ripe old age, satisfied with life. His sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah. Can you see these two clans, these two families? Isaac's family and Ishmael's family have not seen each other for a while. I have officiated at various types of gatherings where family gather who have not seen each other for a while and do not sit in the same aisle. I want you to remember the relationship between Ishmael and Isaac and some of the strain and stress that had happened in that family in the past, but they gathered at their father's burial. And they paid respects to him at Machpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite, facing Mamre, the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. There Abraham was buried with Sarah, his wife. It's interesting, you know, Keturah was also his wife, and she bore him children. But Sarah, that's where he was buried. He was buried next to Sarah. It came about that after the death of Abraham, God blessed his son Isaac. And Isaac lived in Beer Lahai-Roi. Now, that's exactly the transition that I was mentioning when we opened up. It wasn't like the Lord said, oh, now what am I going to do without Abraham? I just, Abraham was the man and he just got too old and now I don't know what to do. It was like the Lord said, okay, Abe, thanks, join me. And his blessing went straight on, folded straight over according to his plan into Isaac's life. And a whole new generation of people were going to be challenged. And interestingly, you're going to see some of the same challenges. If you've read, raise your hand if you read ahead. Well, we see who's in fellowship and who's not. If you read ahead, you would know the similarities. Well, that's okay. It'll be a surprise to you. It'll be a happy little surprise. Every generation in which God works, he reaps and brings in a harvest from one generation. He moves straight on to the next generation. He's already begun to move in the next generation. He's not just moving in your generation. He's moving in the next one. And Abraham is not cold in the grave. He's not in the grave at all, but his body's not cold in the grave before the blessing has been passed directly to Isaac. And that's what's so wonderful about walking with God. You're part of a much broader, much bigger thing. So the blessing goes to Isaac, and that's why, as Moses writes Genesis, one of the main purposes of the gathering together of these documents and of these accounts is to show that God is faithful to the covenant generation to generation to generation. He transcends us. He's more important than us. He's more important than our plans, you see. That's the point. Verse 12. Now, these are also the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, bore to Abraham. Do you ever wonder if God's going to work in somebody's life that you don't get along with? He said, I will bless Ishmael, remember? He said, Abraham, you got to let him go, but I'm going to bless him. Trust me with Ishmael. Let him go. Because Abraham was worried about that way back when. And the Lord said, I'll take care of Ishmael and I will make him a great nation. There are 12 patriarchs with unpronounceable names that are mentioned here that are descendants of Ishmael. And the point is, 12 patriarchs for this son like 12 patriarchs for the other son as well. And God doesn't tell us everything that he does through these people. He leaves it at that. Why? Why does he not trace Ishmael's lineage? Think about it. It's because his purpose is not to give a lineage of everybody in the world. His purpose is to trace the covenant. The covenant that would eventually bless you and me through the Messiah. So he says, I took care of Ishmael. Here are the names of all the people that belonged to Ishmael and where they settled and all that stuff, and then Ishmael died. Now, he picks up again in verse 19. These are the records of the generations of Isaac. Now he starts to spend more time. Why? Because this is where the covenant is. He's tracing the covenant, and God's faithfulness is the highlight here. These are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian, to be his wife. You say, let me point something out here. When they put in all the names and stuff, don't think that that's not important. I'm going to repeat this over and over again. Don't think that the names are boring and unimportant. They are documentation that prove that this is not a made-up story. When these names and all this documentation is in there, it's proof that this really happened. And he puts this in because Rebekah was actually related to Abraham's family, and the covenant had to be kept within that family. They had to marry inside the covenant. That was one of the main things they had to do. It's interesting because one of Isaac's sons doesn't do that. He had to marry inside the covenant. And so that's why Rebekah's lineage is laid out. And Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. And the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. And we find out later, this took 20 years. They got married at 40. These boys were born when he was 60. So for 20 years, Isaac didn't have kids. And you know they were trying. And you know that they had wanted them. And I'll bet you anything, he started praying at the end of the first year. Or maybe even before the end of the first year. They wanted babies immediately. They loved honeymoon babies in those days. That's what they wanted to do. 20 years. Now remember I told you that the strain and the stresses of one generation are often repeated in the next generation. And that's exactly what happened with Abraham and Sarah. Remember, it was 25 years for them. And I bet you that as Isaac was growing up and he married, well, in a sense late, although apparently they waited a while to get married. He married at 40. And I probably married a woman 20 years his junior. But at that point, you got to be wondering if Isaac, as he was growing up and hearing the stories, do you know how long we had to wait for you and we had to trust God and you'd be amazed. And he would have heard this from time immemorial. Now he's 40 years old. His dad's passed away. He's waiting for a child. And he says, I'm going to have to do what my dad did. I'm going to have to trust God. He learned it from Abraham. In fact, Abraham had made such an impact on Isaac that, and continued to, that Isaac actually ended up making some of his mistakes as well as his victories. It's an interesting thing. So he prayed to the Lord, and finally the Lord opened her womb and she conceived. And the children struggled together within her. And she said, if this is so, then why am I this way? If this is so good, why is this happening to me? I had to wait this long. I'm praying for a baby. And here's the baby, babies, plural, and they're kicking each other inside of me. And the NIV renders it accurately. Why is this happening to me? Did you ever ask yourself that? Lord, I asked you for a blessing. I thought you were giving me a blessing. So how come this is happening to me? It must have been bad enough that she cried out to God, which means it was not your average kind of situation. You know, one time my wife and I, Barb and I, when she was pregnant with Kristen, our oldest, were at Bible studies, a matter of fact, and speaking of kicking, and she was about 8.5 months pregnant, something like that. And we were sitting there at this Bible study down at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, and Barb had said, I will not fall asleep in church tonight. And so she drank some coffee. And she was kicked from the middle of that Bible study all the way through the end of it. Kristen was kicking and kicking. And Barb, it kept Barb awake barely by the kicking, not by the caffeine. And she said afterwards, I will never do that again. Have you ever felt a child kick from the outside? Put your hand on a pregnant lady's tummy, which becomes sort of public property. Have you noticed that when you're in a group, especially a bunch of Christians? People, ladies, if you've been pregnant in a group of Christians, they just walk right up, they'll put their hand on your tummy. They would never do that under any other, but they'll go, can I feel the baby? Anyway, you can feel them kick, boom, boom. Can you feel two kids in there kicking each other? kicking each other. It says in the NIV, they jostled each other. It means they kicked each other. It doesn't mean, oh, excuse me. This is, boom, they're kicking each other. And this began a lifelong habit, if you know these two boys. And she says, why is this happening to me? And the Lord said, well, let me tell you, two nations are in your womb. Well, I believe that. When they're at war, these two nations are in your womb. And two peoples shall be separated from your body, and one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. It's a prophecy. What's happening to me? I hate this. Well, let me mention a couple things. First of all, more than you think. Did you notice what he says here? You don't just have a couple of kids kicking you. There are two nations in your womb. What's happening here? More than you think. And they will grow up and they will be strong nations. And it will be something unusual that God will do through them. The older will serve the younger. Very odd, because normally it's the other way around. The older one would get all of the birthright. Well, as you know, it didn't turn out that way. God said it wouldn't turn out that way in this particular case. More than you think, and secondly, better than you think. I'm developing an entire nation. I'm doing something through you that I'm not even telling you all the details. Just trust me. What's going on? Why is this happening to me? I'll tell you what's going on. More than you think. Why? Because it's better than you think. Why? Because you're part of the covenant and God always knows what he's doing. It's a good thing to remember. And notice too that he sees these kids by way of their future. From the time they were conceived. Which, by the way, if you have not come to the final conclusion that abortion is a horrible sin against God, you need to come to that conclusion. Well, I've mentioned it a couple times already, and we haven't even gotten all the way through Genesis yet. You travel all the way through the Bible, you will have no doubt in your mind that humans are humans from conception. Abortion is wrong. And he sees not only two boys, two babies, he sees two whole nations. He sees everything that will ever become. He sees you and all that you will become. He saw that before you were conceived. It's awesome to serve God. It is awesome to know that he knows that much about us. So that when the days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment. And so they named him Hairy. Isn't that imaginative? That's Esau. Esau means hairy. And he was a little fuzzy guy. His whole body was fuzzy. Really. So they called him Fuzzy, basically. Esau. And afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel, and they named him Jacob, which means heel catcher or the grabber of the heel. That's what it... And, you know, they kind of named the first thing that came to their mind, apparently, when they saw these little guys. They didn't decide ahead of time. They said, well, let's name him Harry, and let's name him heel catcher, Jacob. And so they both came out, and Jacob's hanging on, and he would hang on for the rest of his life. He was not going to let go. This hanging on that Jacob does from the time he's born is something that becomes a characteristic of his life. And Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. And when the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Notice the difference between their personalities. Skillful hunter, a man of the field, meaning a man who loved the open spaces. He was gone all the time. He was out hunting all the time. He loved to be hunting all the time, as some of the guys who are actually, even now as we speak, out hunting, because it's a great thing to do, and it's time-honored, and that's the way he liked to do it. Nothing wrong with that, by the way. His other character flaws were not connected to the fact that he just liked hunting, okay? And Jacob's character flaws were not connected to the fact that he stayed with the tents, but he did. In fact, it calls him Tam, T-A-M in Hebrew. He was a Tam man, meaning literally a complete man or a quiet man. You can also render the word ordinary man, and you could also render it, actually, it's sometimes rendered perfect, which I'm sure would have been his preferred rendering of the term if you had asked him, but he was far from perfect. What it means is a complete person who's quiet in his spirit. There was an old rendering, smooth. And you have a hairy man, Esau, you have a smooth man, Jacob. Very, very different brothers. Very opposite in their personalities. And Jacob hung around the tents. He learned to cook. And I can imagine Esau coming in from the field. Yeah, how's the cooking going, Jacob? Can you imagine these two? Verse 28. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Interesting, huh? A little bit of dysfunction going on here, a little favoritism happening in the family, an unwise way to live, and it bears bitter fruit in a couple of chapters because these two play each other off against each other. They must not read anything by James Dobson. That's all I can figure. You know, it's interesting how many dysfunctional families are in the Bible. You say, well, I come from a dysfunctional family. Can God use me? You know what? In the Bible, it's a prerequisite. You have to come from a dysfunctional family. Almost every marriage was difficult, and almost all the children rebelled against their parents. I mean, it was just like a lot of stuff happened to these people. So, Isaac loves Esau because he had a taste for game, and Rebekah loved Jacob. And Jacob had cooked stew. And Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. He'd been out there running around chasing game, and he comes in. Esau says to Jacob, hey, give me some, swallow that red stuff there. I'm famished. That's why his name is Red. Edom was the nation that would come from this man Esau. Esau, whose name was Harry, gave birth to the nation called Edom, which was always something of an enemy to Israel. Jacob gave birth to the nation called Israel. In fact, Jacob's name was later changed to Israel later in his life. Esau, Edom, Jacob, Israel. Esau liked red stuff to eat, and that's where the nickname Edom came from, and that's where that nation got its name, was from Esau. What this stew was, we don't know. But imagine something tasty when you're really hungry. Okay? It probably, what they were eating on that particular day, if you had some right now, probably was not as tasty as you would wish. But you imagine something tasty to you when you think of this. He's tired, he's hungry, he's famished. He says, I want something to eat. And Jacob said, I'll trade you for the birthright. Sell me your birthright. I had a hold of your heel when you were born. Now, I want your birthright. I want to be the firstborn. Now, the reason this is in here is not because Esau could actually give him the birthright yet. The reason this is in here is because in a couple of chapters, which we won't get to tonight, but in a couple of chapters, when Jacob tricks Esau, you remember how the story goes. You guys all know the story, right, from the flannel boards when you were in Sunday school. You remember how Jacob tricks his dad and takes the blessing. The purpose of this part of the story is to remind us at that time that this is what the boys really wanted. Okay? That's the purpose for this. Because really, Esau really couldn't give the birthright. It was up to the father to give. Oh, what this is here for is to show us that Esau didn't care about it. And that's why the last line in the chapter is the way it is. Esau didn't care about it, and Jacob did care about it. He says, I do care about being a firstborn, and I want to be the firstborn. So if you're so hungry, I want you to, you give me the rights to the firstborn. Now that's a lot that would involve a huge amount of property and authority, but more important than that, it involves the covenant with God, because the covenant goes to the firstborn. And so Jacob says, I want that. And Esau said, look, I'm about to die. Oh, come on. I'm about to die. So what use is the birthright to me? Have you ever noticed when you are being tempted to do something you know is really wrong and really stupid, how your brain will figure out a rationale why you ought to do it anyway. Even though there's a little bell going off in the back of your head going, no, no, don't do this, don't do it. Your brain goes, yeah. And this is the rationale. I'm going to die if I don't eat right this minute. If I'm just going to die, so what good will it do me if I'm dead? So therefore, okay, you can have the birthright. And Jacob says, swear to me. I happen to have a contract right here. Sign on the dotted line, says Jacob. This is interesting because it means he's been thinking about this. Jacob must have been thinking for some time, I would make a better firstborn than Esau. Or even if I wouldn't, I would rather be. I actually think in terms of the future, and Esau doesn't. And so I would do better with this. And so when the opportunity arose, he made a deal and he drove it home. And he said, sign right here. And so he did. He swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew. Here, have a little more, Esau. Eat up, buddy. Enjoy. And he ate, and he drank, and he rose, and he went on his way. And here's the key line, the whole thing. Thus Esau despised his birthright. And that's the reason that whole story is there. To show the difference in their personalities, but also to show the difference in their priorities. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 16, refers to Esau as an immoral man who sold his birthright for the old King James, I think, renders it, a mess of pottage, which I think is a mess of pottage is a great way to put it, very picturesque, you know. A bowl of stew is what it was, but it's kind of a mess of pottage. Don't you wonder sometimes, if there are not messes of pottage in our lives for which we are willing to sell out things far more valuable, because at the moment we don't feel like that really valuable thing is very valuable to us. Did you ever notice that? And the enemy uses that kind of logic in our minds. Esau had it in his heart that he didn't care about his birthright. Jacob cared very much about it. And we'll see how that works out as we finish up this evening. But I just want to ask you, if there's not a mess of pottage in your life and you're saying to yourself, or maybe you're maybe you're making a decision that afterwards you may ask yourself, did I make the right decision? Did I sell out something far more valuable to me than what it is I'm trying to get a hold of here? It happens. People make these kinds of decisions. Chapter 26. Now there was a famine in the land, besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. Remember I told you there would be similar trials in each generation. That's exactly what happens. He faces a famine in the land. And what do you do when there's a famine in the land of Canaan? You guys should remember from Abraham, what did they do when there was a famine in the land of Canaan? You go to Egypt. Now the way to get to Egypt is to go through Philistia, what we call the Gaza Strip. That's where Gerar was. Gerar was in what we call the Gaza Strip, which is down in the flat land next to the Mediterranean, out of the hill country of Israel. And that's what he does. He goes down and he meets with Abimelech, and he's on his way to Egypt. And the reason we know that is in verse 2, the Lord tells him not to go to Egypt. Verse 2, and the Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I will tell you. You stay right here. Sojourn in this land, and I'll be with you, and I will bless you, meaning the land of the Philistines. God didn't say, go back to the hill country where there was less water even. And remember that a famine was always caused by a drought, almost always. And so when you went higher into what they call the Shephelah, into the foothills there, moving up into Israel, the mountains of Israel, the higher you got, the further you got away from the springs and the wells, and the quicker they would go dry, apparently. And so the people would move down to get into what they needed to have. And the Lord says, I want you to stay here, but you can stay here in the lowland. You don't have to go back up to the high land where you came from, but you can stay here. Why? Because all of this land will eventually be his. It was all Canaan. But don't go to Egypt. Egypt was a place that he was not supposed to go. So he could stay in the land of the Philistines because it really was technically part of what would eventually be the land of Israel. So you stay here. He says, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and I'll give your descendants all these lands by which your descendants and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. It's exactly what he told Abraham. But Abraham obeyed me and kept, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Do as I tell you, Isaac, you stay right here. So Isaac did it. He lived in Gerar. And the men of the place asked him about his wife, and he said, is this a great line? She is my sister. Where did he learn that trick? From Papa. From Dad. He must have heard the story. I don't know if Abraham told him. I doubt that Abraham said, now, if you ever travel, son, you be sure and tell everybody that your wife is your sister, especially if she's good looking, because they'll just kill you for her. I don't think he would have said that. I think what happened is Isaac remembered, because the story's in the camp, he remembered how Dad dealt with problems. And Dad is much more of an example than he sometimes realizes he is. Isn't that the truth? So It's interesting. Isaac does the exact same thing. She's my sister. For he was afraid to say my wife, thinking the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah because she's beautiful. And it came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked out his window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife Rebekah. And so he looks down there, and it's a rather graphic word that's being used here, and he's going, that is not his sister. I've seen brothers and sisters before, and they don't do that. And so he gets pretty upset. And he goes down, and Abimelech called Isaac. He said, behold, certainly she is your wife. What are you talking about, you slimeball? How then? Hebrew word for slimeball. How then do you say to me, she's my sister? And Isaac said to him, well, because I thought lest I die on account of her. Thought you'd kill me. And Abimelech said, what is this you've done to us? One of my people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. Very interesting thing. What he meant was, it was kind of open game on attractive women. They could simply take them. That's why they were well protected in their families. But notice, as well as that, which we might question the morality of that kind of a culture, notice the other side of the coin. This pagan realized that because she was married, he must not touch her. And you remember, that's exactly the same thing that the Philistine king had said before, and the king of Egypt said the same thing, and these were pagans. And they knew that it would bring cosmic, what we would call cosmic guilt, eternal guilt upon them, because she was married. You notice the value that they placed on marriage, even though they did not place a very high value on women always, and there were many other problems in their culture, and sins and so on, but they placed a very high value on marriage. And part of his anger is that he was put in danger by the deed of, by being tricked about who this woman was. He felt he was in danger, and his whole nation was in danger because he felt God would even judge his whole nation based on this. Isn't that amazing? So Abimelech charged all of his people, and he said, he who touches this man or his wife will surely be put to death. Now, this is sort of left over from Abraham's legacy as well. The Philistines knew that Abraham belonged to God. And so they respected Abraham's family, and they respected Isaac. Now, Isaac sowed in that land, and he reaped in the same year 100-fold. 100-fold. He sowed one tomato plant, got 100 back. That's what we're talking about here. Sowed one zucchini. It's that time of year where if you leave your windows open in the church parking lot, zucchinis appear on the seat of your car. And in the church kitchen, zucchini, everywhere is zucchini. Well, 100-fold, he had a lot of zucchini and a lot of everything. You know, it was just the Lord was blessing him. The man became rich. He continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. He was wealthy already. He became extremely wealthy. Possessions, flocks, herds, a great household. And the Philistines envied him. And all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines had stopped up by filling them with earth. And Abimelech said to Isaac, get out of here. You're too powerful for us. You got to get away. You got to move. So Isaac departed from there, and he camped in the valley of Gerar, and he settled there. Now watch this. Because God is blessing him, he does not leave the land of the Philistines for a long time. But he does have to keep moving around because the Philistines don't like him because he's so wealthy. And Isaac dug, again, the wells of water which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, for the Philistines had stopped him up after the death of Abraham, and he gave them the same names which his father had given him. And when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of flowing water, it's an artesian well, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with the herdsmen of Isaac, and they said, the water's ours! You can see these guys fighting over this stuff. So he named that well Esek, which means contention, and because they contended with him. Then so he moved on, he dug another. He'd rather switch than fight. He's not going to fight these people. You know, he really doesn't need to, because God said, I will take care of you. You do not have to fight about the wells. And so he just moved on, dug another well. And then they fought over that one too. He called it Sitna, which means enmity. And he moved away from there, dug another well. And they didn't quarrel over that one, so he named it Rehoboth, which means broad place, because the Lord has made room for us. Finally, we've got a place to live. And so they didn't fight over the well. He went up from there to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared to him the same night. He said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear. Must have been a little fearful. Don't fear. I am with you. I will bless you, and I will multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. Now look at verse 25 and circle some things. So he built an altar there, circle the word altar, and he called upon the name of the Lord, and he pitched his tent, circle the word tent, and there Isaac's servants dug a well, circle the word well. Just a little sidelight here. Notice that when God has spoken to you and you're part of his covenant, the altar comes first, then the tent, then the well. You can tent someplace and drink surface water, but if you're going to stay, you dig a well. And it's interesting that before he builds the tent, he builds the altar, and before he digs the well, he puts in the tent, and then finally, he puts in the well. The spiritual things come first. You follow the Lord, you let yourself be part of his covenant, you be loyal to him, and see if these other things don't follow. God took care of him. He said, I will take care of you. You stay where you are. You stay in my covenant. You stay in the promised land. That's what he's saying. And I will take care of you. And he did. Took care of him. Even though he had to move and change and he had to give up this and he gave up one well after another until finally he had one there. And then when he moved back to Beersheba, the Lord reaffirmed that covenant. He says, right here, an altar, a tent, and then a well. Let the altar come first. So Abimelech came to him, verse 26, from Gerar, and with his advisor, Ahazath, and Phicol, the commander of his army. And Isaac said, what are you doing here? You don't like me. Why have you come? Since you hate me, he says, and you sent me away from you. And they said, well, we see plainly that the Lord has been with you. So he said, let there now be an oath between us, even between you and us, and we'll make a covenant with you, and you will do us no harm. Just as we have not touched you and have not we have done nothing but good to you and have sent you away in peace, you are now blessed of the Lord. And he made them a feast, and they ate and drank. They came, they didn't have to do this, but they came up and they said, we want peace with you. They were, his tents, his clan was probably rival in size to one of their cities. Can you imagine? And they said, we don't want a war with this guy. God is blessing him. Let's leave him alone. Let's make peace with him. And he made them a feast, and they ate and drank. And the morning they arose early, and they exchanged oaths. Which, that means they promised things to each other. But I've heard people exchange oaths often. And I wonder if behind all of this, some other oaths had not been thought of in the past between these two men. You know, it's an interesting thing how many times God uses enmity and then forces people to make a connection and make peace. There was a time when they would have used a different kind of oath with each other, and they would have said things to each other that were not polite at all. But God says, listen, I am forcing there to be peace between you. And so they took oaths, not the bad kind, but the good kind. So we promise before God, we will not make war on each other. And Isaac's servants, verse 32, came to him, and they said, we found water, and he called it Sheba. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba, to this day. Now, Esau was 40 years old, and he married Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basmath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Fascinating way to end that chapter. It's interesting that's put in there. The reason it's put in at the end, you notice at the end of chapter 25, Esau despised his birthright, didn't care. At the end of chapter 26, Esau despised his parents, married outside the faith, and brought grief to his parents. Don't lose the connection there between those things about Esau. He was a man who was not on page at all with what his parents were about and with what God was doing. Well, I want to just close up. Just a couple things to remember. Thoughts about God and us that you see in here. First is this, God is patient. So we should take a long view of life. God is patient, and that means we need to take a long view. That's exactly what Jacob did. He took a long view. Esau took a short view of life. I want what I want now. I don't care what I have to sell out in the future. Don't do that. God is very patient, and he takes a long time to get everything done, but he's going to get it done. So take a long, long view of all the decisions that you're making. Think in terms of investment in the future. Think in terms of what you're going to be 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years from now. Don't think in terms of what you want right this minute. Take a long view. Why? Because God is patient. 20 years he took before he brought these sons in to continue that covenant. You serve a patient God, so be patient and take the long view. Make the long-term investment in your life. Secondly, God is sovereign, so we should make faithful decisions. I'm gonna spell that one out. Because God is sovereign, it means he's going to win. That means you want to be on his side. That means you want to find out what he thinks and make faithful decisions based on what he says is important. Esau didn't do that. Jacob did do that. Moral of the story? Make a really faithful decision. Interestingly, everybody gets what they want. Esau got what he wanted. He didn't want God, and he didn't get God. Jacob got what he wanted. He wanted the birthright, and he wanted God eventually. At first, he wasn't quite sure about that, but he figured it out. And he had God. You know, in the book of Romans, chapter 2, it says the same thing. It's a shock when I tell people that I really believe every human being gets what they want. Every human being gets what they want in eternity. Somehow, mysteriously, God's will and human will do fit together. We don't know exactly how, because he sovereignly said, this is the way it's going to be. But then, amazingly, as it turned out, it's exactly the way the boys wanted it. And it wasn't because God simply looked into the future to see what they were going to do. He doesn't have to do that. It's because he's so smart. God is so smart that he can make his will and our will work together in some way. And you know what that means is? It means you can rest in his sovereignty, but it means you also have to make good decisions. And that's what I'm pointing out. You can rest in his sovereignty, but you have to make good decisions. God is sovereign, so you have to make faithful decisions at all times because he's sovereign. Let me tell you what people sometimes think. God is sovereign, so I can make a bunch of stupid decisions and he'll bail me out of them later. That's really not good thinking. God is sovereign, so make good decisions because he's going to win and you want to be with him when it happens. So, third, God is gracious, so we should be grateful. Gracious, and by gracious I mean sovereignly so. He said, I'm going to use the second son, not the first one. I'm going to use the second son, not the first one. And you know, interestingly, he uses a lot of people that we would think he wouldn't use. Let me quote John Salehammer, who happens to be the Old Testament prof at the seminary where I'm pursuing a degree right now. And he wrote an interesting thing about this. He said this, as far back as chapter 4, the narrative has portrayed God choosing and approving the younger and the weaker through whom he would accomplish his purpose and bring about his blessing. The offering of Cain, the older brother, was rejected, whereas the offering of the younger brother, Abel, was accepted. The line of Seth, the still younger brother, was the chosen line. Isaac was chosen over his brother, his older brother, Ishmael. Rachel was chosen over her older sister, Leah. We'll get to that later. Joseph, the younger brother, was chosen over all the rest. Judah was chosen over his older brothers. The intention behind each of these reversals was the recurring theme of God's sovereign plan of grace. The blessing was not a natural right. That is rich. Listen to that again. The blessing was not a natural right. It's not a right to be blessed by God. It's given to people who don't deserve it. That's what he's saying here. I will do what I will do, says God. And I will give grace freely to people who don't deserve it, who had no right to expect it. It was not a natural right as a right of the firstborn son would be. Rather, God's blessing is extended to those who have no other claim to it. They all received what they did not deserve. Now listen, once you start looking for that, you guys, in the Bible, once you start looking for God to do that, you find it all through the Scripture. And especially in the life of Jesus. Especially in the life of Jesus, who seemed to delight in, read the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the people who don't expect that life is going to treat them very well. Oh, it's on and on and on. God says, I will turn all of the stuff of this world upside down and I will pour grace out. Awesome. So we should be grateful. God is patient. We should take the long view of life. God is sovereign. So we should make faithful decisions. And God is gracious. So we should be grateful. You know, these men lived faithful lives, but they did not live flawless lives. They lived faithful, but not flawless lives. If you're looking at the flaws in your life and you're thinking, well, then maybe God can't use me, think again. Think again. You don't have to be flawless. You just have to admit who you are in order to be used by the Lord, in order to be part of His covenant. And that reminds you of this last thing. You can live a blessed life, even if it's not a charmed life. You can live a blessed life, even if it's not a charmed life. People say, well, I should live a charmed life. I should live, you know, the perfect life. There is no perfect life. I mean, look at these lives. Look at all that went wrong in these lives. And yet we look back and we say, look at how God blessed. Look at how faithful He was. Because their lives counted for more than their lives. Because they belonged to God. You can live a very blessed life and it still not be what we would call a charmed life. You do it by making those decisions, by walking with God and trusting Him. Let's pray. Father, we see who You are. We see Your faithfulness. We trust You. And especially we trust You when decisions in our lives that others have made, perhaps, have affected us, that have made us feel unusable to You, unworthy to You. Lord, we trust You and Your grace. We see how You turn the tables on the way the world thinks all the time. And we ask, Father, that our lives would indeed count for more than what we see here on earth. And that when life here on earth doesn't look very good, we might look to the covenant blessings that we have in Christ Jesus our Lord. Thank You for these accounts, for these stories, Lord, that are true and speak to our souls. And thank You for challenging us to walk with You in Jesus' name. Amen.